Support for the full story comes from the Heart and Vascular Center at Bridgeport Hospital, where advanced cardiovascular treatments are met with compassion and a uniquely personalized approach to care. Learn more at bridgeporthospital.org/heart.
Salt marshes. They're coastal wetlands with spongy, wet peat-filled earth. The air is touched with a scent of sulfur. And then there are mosquitoes. Doesn't sound all that attractive, does it? And in fact, many of them have been lost to dredging, drainage, landfills, and other man-made alterations. But salt marshes are essential. They've been described as a barrier to climate change, and they're home to a diversity of wildlife, and they're the focus of scientific research and restoration. The Stuart B. McKinney National Wildlife Refuge in Connecticut includes salt marsh. Rick Potvin is the manager of the Great Meadows Unit in Stratford. Mr. Potvin, welcome to The Full Story.
Well, thank you for having me.
Certainly, and he joins us via Zoom. First of all, please tell us a bit more about the Wildlife Refuge. I understand it has units scattered around Connecticut. It's not just one location.
That's correct. So we have units that we manage from Westbrook all the way down to Greenwich. Some of them are land units that have salt marshes. Some of them are nearshore islands. We also manage an offshore island, Faulkner Island. If you're ever at the town dock in Guildford and you look out and you see that lighthouse on the island, that's Faulkner Island. We also manage some of the last remaining maritime forests left in the state here at Westbrook. So we have a lot of different coastal habitats, which is quite amazing for one of the third most populous states in the Union, as well as one of the most developed coastlines.
I should mention, too, Stuart B. McKinney, a former congressman from Connecticut. And when was the Wildlife Refuge established?
Well, the first unit, which was the Salt Meadow Unit, celebrates 50 years this year. So 50 years that the Fish and Wildlife Service was here. When we began to bring other units into the refuge, the name was changed to Connecticut Coastal Island National Wildlife Refuge. Mm-hmm. And shortly after Congressman McKinney died, Congress rechanged our name to Stuart B. McKinney to honor his legacy of environmental protection and helping to establish different units of the refuge.
I'd like to talk a bit more about salt marsh, part of the refuge in Connecticut. What role does a salt marsh play in the ecosystem, generally speaking?
Well, the salt marshes, they are such productive areas. When you think about Long Island Sound, you think about fish, you think about all these other species that are using Long Island Sound. However, without the salt marshes, we would lose the nursery for the sound. So many of the fish that would not lay their eggs out in the open ocean because of predators, they would use the sounds to lay their eggs so their young the young fish can mature, become more able to escape predation before they go out. Salt marshes help clean the water with shellfish and stuff that inhabit the shallows, provides food for migratory birds coming through as well as other forms of wildlife. So the biological importance of the salt marsh is much further than the actual salt marsh itself. If we didn't have active, productive salt marshes, we wouldn't have as many animals living in Long Island Sound because we would have taken their nursery away. So biologically, they're incredibly powerful areas to produce life.
How much of the Connecticut coast can be described as salt marsh? Is it specific locations? Is it stretched along the entire coastline, something in between?
Well, as you said in the beginning, the amount of salt marsh has decreased. So it depends. You have to have the right topography for creation of a salt marsh, but usually they're found on the edge of the bay, maybe behind a barrier beach. Hamannassack State Park has a very large salt marsh compound. So if you live by one, you probably know it. They are long, flat, and brown right along the edge of the water. So I can't give you exactly the numbers of them. But at the refuge, the Great Meadows Unit is one of the larger ones still remaining in the state.
So at one time, and I guess stretching back a number of years, they weren't considered to be all that important. I guess as we mentioned in the intro here, lots of man-made alterations kind of destroyed a bunch of them, and that was before we had a clue as to what they were contributing to the ecosystem.
I believe that's a fair statement. When you look at it, there was these large areas that you couldn't build a house on or you couldn't put industry on. They were open spaces, so they were a good place to put things. So down at Great Meadows, when they dredged Bridgeport Harbor, they took their dredge spoils and dumped them into the marsh, increasing the elevation. For Great Meadows Marsh, if you look back through its history, there was a lot of plans for it. At one point, it was supposed to be a racetrack. One point, it was supposed to be a deep water port for container ships. So all these things were being used, and they were thinking, hey, I have this fill material. Hey, let's get rid of the marsh. We'll fill in the marsh. We'll make it productive lands, or what we would think would be productive land, with putting businesses or homes on them and stuff like that. And you're right. These actions were occurring when we did not understand the full importance of salt marsh and what these changes that we were creating on the salt marsh would lead to later on. So they were not thought of, but now that we know a little bit more and that we have studied those, we see how they're a very important and integral part of the biological function of our area here on Long Island Sound, but also how it increases the value of our natural resources around us.
I did a series of reports, this goes back to the 1990s, about the various ecosystems around Long Island Sound. And one specific place that that we looked at was an area near what's known as Sikorsky Airport, which is in the town of Stratford, but operated by the city of Bridgeport. And one edge of that airport, and I recall this because I had a relative living nearby, there was just a field of those, I believe they called them phragmites, those long cattail weeds that would just burn every year. And I understood those to be things that grew in freshwater. And that occurred because the salt water had been blocked from coming in toward that end of the airport to mitigate any problems with flooding. Was that a salt marsh that was destroyed?
Yes, if you take a look at that map there, the refuge is located in that area. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the acquisition boundary or where we're acquired a land goes on the other side of that road where those cattails are, or not cattails, but phragmites. So phragmites is an invasive species. It's not native here to the United States, and you're correct. Phragmites needs fresh water to survive. So when you see phragmites in a salt marsh, you know that somehow the hydrology has changed. Either it's not allowing the influx of salt water or it's trapping fresh water. And down at Great Meadows, that's one of the things that we're trying to solve. We had a lot of phragmites coming in, and it was because that there was dikes put across the marsh to help fill it in. And one of the things is to reestablish those natural flushings of the tides. So the fresh the salt water comes in, it will not support phragmites. It will support the native species that are used to growing into a salt marsh. And it will also allow rainwater and storm runoff that might have collected in the marsh that is properly fresh water and then to exit the marsh. Also, what the standing water on the marsh, not only for phragmites, unfortunately, it's a very good habitat for mosquitoes. So, you know, when we look at, and we all seen the problems with mosquitoes and mosquitoes-driven disease that affect the residents here in Connecticut, is that some of these marshes have been created into mosquito habitat. And one of our objectives with our restoration at Great Meadows was to alter that mosquito habitat so it could not support breeding mosquitoes anymore. So that was a major part of our project.
So we've talked a bit about man-made alterations to salt marshes over the years in efforts to correct those changes. What about climate change and rising sea levels. Does that have an impact on these wetlands too?
Oh, certainly. So, in fact, in our restoration project, we are looking at climate change predictions and trying to build a marsh that would last much longer with different elevations. So as climate change, as sea level rises, that's the a big threat to salt marshes. We get more water that comes onto the marsh, and these plants grow very well in salt water as long as there's tidal flushing, so that their feet are dry part of the day. But if we have continuous standing salt water on the marshes, that will kill off the grasses. And then the grasses are what holds the silt and other very soft materials that are in the marshes. So then they begin to erode away and we lose the marsh platform, as they say. So yes, that's a big thing that we have to look at. And also for some very interesting birds down at Great Meadows, we have a little bird called the salt marsh sparrow, who lives just above the high tide. And when we have the large new moon tides, after that, sparrows come in, they make their nest, and they have to produce their young so the young can escape the next full moon tide within about 30 days that will happen in the next month. So right now they're laying on the edge. Now you add sea level rise to that, you start shortening that ability to get your family raised and out of the nest before it floods. And this species is very interesting because it only exists between Maine and Virginia. And this very, very small sliver along the coast, which are the salt marshes. So this is a species that is really impaired by sea level rise that we believe is caused by climate change.
The work that you're doing with the salt marshes in Connecticut, I think you described in an article in the Connecticut Mirror, the CT Mirror, you said salt marshes are a key barrier against climate change. You mean the effects of climate change and, for instance, what you just described as the needs that that particular sparrow has?
Sure. And it's also that a functioning marsh, a working marsh, adds protection to the communities and the lands behind it. Because you think that, you know, we talk about Hurricane Sandy or one of these big storms, and unfortunately we're getting more and more winter storms. Well, you get, remember that a storm is just a big pile of energy, and the energy is moving towards shore, it's pushing water, it's creating these flooding events. But when that happens, it hits the marsh. The marsh is able to dissipate that water out before it reaches where maybe we have homes or industry or community areas. So it absorbs the water, absorbs the energy, and just protecting the communities behind it. And unlike, so we would say that, you know, that this was like green infrastructure. Certainly a marsh, to maintain a marsh is probably cheaper than maintaining a barrier. A constructed barrier. So yes, that's another vital role that these marshes do for us citizens here in Connecticut. They help protect our homes and our businesses during these coastal storms, and unfortunately they seem to be increasing.
Mm. I'm speaking with Rick Potvin, a manager with the Stuart B. McKinney National Wildlife Refuge in Connecticut. I understand the Great Meadows unit in Stratford is getting a $4 million restoration. Has that begun already? What are the details of that project?
Yes, we. when I came here 16 years ago, I was contracted by some colleagues who said, "Rick, we have a fast track project. We're going to restore Great Meadows," and we actually put the first shovel in the ground this winter.
Oh, so, wow.
So 16 years, so that's almost half a career to work on a project. And we've had fantastic partners. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the Restoration Center in Rhode Island, has been the main federal partner, providing planning and funding through their hazardous waste program. There were areas that were contaminated by hazardous waste. with the agreement with the government, those companies that were responsible for it had to pay some money to try to mitigate those damages. And we used that money to come up with the plans. And then we had Audubon Connecticut, who came in, and they've been the principal fundraisers for this project. So from the about, we had about $1 million, a little less than $1 million of federal funding. And Audubon Connecticut came in and raised the vast majority of that. So they were fantastic partners. It's very many different organizations come together, including the state of Connecticut, who have been a great partner. And so what we're trying to do there at Great Meadows is we're trying to restore natural hydrology. We're trying to do a little experiment to make hummocks in the marsh for the salt marsh sparrows. There is a plant called the marsh pink that only exists one place in Connecticut, and that is Great Meadows. So we're starting a restoration project for marsh pink, a little beautiful flower, and then the other species, and also for fish species. So this $4 million seems a lot of money, but you know, the value of these salt marshes was determined in a study by a college, and they said that 1 square mile of functioning salt marsh is worth close to $700,000. So wow. We're renovating 35 acres of salt marsh. So this will be there, you know, if we want to look at value and stuff, yeah, $4 million, but we're getting most of that back in value. Also, we're hoping that as we put the native species in, we're taking out a lot of unnative species, that will get new wildlife that people can come down and visit the marsh and view these new these species of wildlife that they might not have seen before. And hopefully that we've worked on the mosquitoes and they won't be bitten when they come down to view the wildlife.
You mentioned before restoring the natural hydrology. Just to define that a bit, in other words, you're talking about what would be the sort of natural ebb and flow of the tides coming in and out, which are impeded due to changes that have been made either due to climate change or man-made alterations.
Yeah, that's correct. So down at Great Meadows, it was a lot of diking. They would make a big dike around a section of marsh, and then they would start filling it in. So those are areas that we're working on. We're making openings through the dike out into Lewis Gut and Long Island Sound. And so, yes, by reestablishing the flow of salt water and tides supports the native species. The native species are specially designed to live in those marshes. That makes it more healthy marsh and more resilient against climate change, but also more resilient against coastal storms that protect the infrastructure of the city of Stratford that's behind it.
Does a project like this have a projected end date, or is this kind of an open-ended thing where changes need to occur as you know, nature deals with what you're doing in terms of restoration?
Yeah, we in the service, we call that adaptive management. So we have the plans. We're fairly confident. We're confident in our planning that we built this, but now we have to monitor it. So actually the dirt moving is coming to an end now. Audubon Connecticut is doing a huge volunteer push almost every weekend for the next couple weekends to plant native grasses out on the meadow where it was now all the phragmites have been removed. So this will be an oncoming effort. So we do have money in the project to monitor the situation, to monitor the meadow for the next 2 to 3 years. And if we see, hey, this worked out very well, then we know we did something well. And if we say, hey, this isn't responding the way that we want, we will still have funding in this and the expertise to say, let's go and tweak it now and make sure that it works the way we want it. So you're right. We'll probably be studying this restoration for many years to come.
Rick Potvin is a manager with the Stuart B. McKinney National Wildlife Refuge in Connecticut. Mr. Potvin, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
As we mentioned, many salt marshes were lost to development at a time when their value to our natural environment was not well understood. Jim Turek is a restoration ecologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and he's here now via Zoom to help us better understand what it takes to reverse the damage. Mr. Turek, welcome to The Full Story.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be here. Hopefully I can answer some of your questions today.
I'm sure you can. How is it that NOAA is involved with salt marsh restoration?
Well, so I work for NOAA's Restoration Center. We have folks like myself throughout the country, including the Great Lakes, focused on doing various types of ecological restoration that benefit fishery resources and other living resources in the marine environment. And so salt marshes, of course, are the habitat that separates typically the ocean from our landscape. And so we have been working on ecological restoration since about 1992, and in particular salt marshes soon thereafter. And so I work for the Restoration Center, and I work out of Rhode Island, but I cover southern New England, including Connecticut and Long Island Sound and its watershed.
Mm. How do you know when a salt marsh is in trouble?
Well, that's a great question. We've seen some incredibly rapid changes in our salt marshes in southern New England in the last two decades. And one of the main culprits, setting aside all the different people impacts over the last couple hundred years, and in particular the last 50 plus years, but most recently, with sea level rise, we have seen some amazing changes to the detriment of our salt marshes. Basically, the fact that these marshes have had trouble with these with sea level rise that's increasingly occurring due to climate change. And so what we're seeing is these marshes are becoming wetter, in essence, waterlogged, and the plant communities that have that are adapted to living in a wet environment are having trouble because the peat that these plants live in are becoming wetter and wetter, and therefore they're having trouble trying to keep up with the sea level rise over time. So we're seeing more and more water on the marshes that do not drain, that does not drain. And the plant communities just cannot keep up with them. And so we're losing the plant community as well as the faunal communities, the animals that live in this community disappearing.
Well, I would think it's one thing to try to undo sort of man-made alterations that have occurred over, you know, the many years, several hundred, as you pointed out, a couple of hundred. But when it comes to something like sea level rising, which is not something we can easily reverse at the moment, how do you counter that when it comes to its effect on a salt marsh?
Yeah, so that's another good question. So, like I said earlier, most of our natural marshes in southern New England have a substrate made of peat. The plant itself, these plants break down, and the organic matter accumulates. If it accumulates at a rate that's conducive to keeping up with sea level rise, that's one thing. But what we're seeing is, of course, the peat accumulation is much reduced. And so to be able to address this increasing sea level rise rate, we have found that we can put mineral soils on top of some of this degrading peat to hopefully address increase in elevation that allows the plant community to then come back and at least be sustainable in the nearer term, if it all works correctly. And when I say mineral soils, this is basically a material that, we found ways to secure old dredge soils for some of our sites, and basically increasing what we define as the elevation capital And it's a vertical, we think about vertical capital to bring up the elevation of the marsh to address this accelerating sea level rise.
It sounds like that might be one of the most challenging parts of restoring or maintaining a salt marsh, trying to keep ahead of sea level rise. Is that a losing battle?
It's a very difficult battle that we face. So there's a couple different ways to look at it. Sea level rise is not going to go away. We all know that. We've learned that through climate change, the rates of rise are increasing due to multiple factors. And one way is to, of course, allow for natural marsh migration. And so if you have a landscape, an upland landscape available for the marsh to move landward, that's one way that occurs naturally, and it does happen. The problem with that is in developed landscapes, much of the Connecticut shoreline, it makes it very, very difficult to find where marsh migration can and will occur. But if we can do that, then we should be hopefully securing and protecting some of that landscape to allow for marsh migration in the future. In places where we can't do that, then we try to look at, can we put soils down in locations where we have degrading marsh, where we have more standing water, shallow water, and places where the marsh plant community either no longer exists or there is indications that it's failing. And so we try to find these places where we can conveniently try to restore marsh by putting soils into those locations.
During the years when sea level rise was not the primary or a primary cause of damage to salt marsh, and you just touched on development, during the years when sort of ignoring the fact that a salt marsh had a value was something that people did, do you know how much salt marsh was lost in our region as a result of people altering the landscape?
I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but as I recall, like in the Connecticut, Long Island Sound area, I believe it was somewhere on the order of 60 to 70% or so of the original salt marsh that existed was lost by land development. And so we often saw places that the marshes were filled in particular. First, they were often drained. So there were ditches that were put in to drain the water off the marshes and then either filled or converted to non-wetland. And so that's where a lot of loss occurred. And we have now seen that some of the areas where it may be possible to take some of that fill off that was put down, and that's what we've done over the last 6 months or so down in Stratford, Connecticut, at the Great Meadows Marsh, where we've actually taken dredge soils that were placed from Bridgeport Harbor in about 1955. They were placed onto the old salt marsh, filled, and now what we're doing is taking some of that fill off to restore the marsh to the right elevation, like I talked about earlier, by having an elevation that's conducive to restoring the salt marsh.
How much salt marsh is NOAA involved in restoring right now?
Well, certainly thousands of acres across the country along the coast, both the East Coast and the West Coast, the East Coast more so, and in the Northeast in particular. We've worked on over 65 projects in the Northeast region since about 1998 or so. And a lot of those projects related to culvert replacements. And so we had what's called tidal restrictions. And so the way marshes work is to have a normal daily tide twice a day come in and out of a salt marsh to make the tides flood the tide and then drain the marsh as well. And we have worked on a number of these projects, basically those were mostly done by around 2010. And we've done fewer projects like that since then, but we are now refocusing on how to address the need for elevational gain to address climate change and sea level rise.
I was going to ask you, if projects are ever finished, or are they the type of thing where there's always more to do? You've sort of just answered that question, though.
There's always more to do. When we worked on these culvert replacements for tidal reintroduction to the marshes, what we found is, yes, we increased and restored the tidal exchange, but what we learned from those experiences is that the substrate, the peat within these marshes were so far degraded that once the tides are brought back, the marsh dropped very quickly in elevation. And once it became too low, again, we could not get reestablishment of the plant community that we really wanted to. And so now we're looking at what's called adaptive management measures to try to, again, bring up the elevation, the marsh capital, to allow the plant community to restore, as well as the animals that live within that marsh. And so it's a great challenge, and it will be in the future with continued sea level rise.
Is it possible to create new salt marshes, so to speak, where they weren't before, or does that sort of defeat the purpose of maintaining a natural environment?
Yes, we can certainly do what's called marsh creation. It requires taking uplands, you know, in many cases, vacant land, if you will, land that may be old agricultural fields. Those are the classic in that you're basically taking a upland non-wetland soils that were once agricultural and for the most part are probably sitting idle. And so if we don't have, for example, a forest community that has now come back in those locations, we could use those sites to excavate soils strategically to plan for marsh creation or more marsh migration. And so that is an option. Although in Connecticut, land is hard to come by like that, as you probably know. I mean, a lot of our landscape along the Connecticut shoreline is developed, and then areas that are not developed might be rocky outcrops that are just not going to be conducive to putting a marsh there. And so we are having a more and more difficult time to find the sweet spots where marsh creation and or marsh migration can occur.
Jim Turek is a restoration ecologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Mr. Turek, thanks for your insights and information about restoring salt marshes. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here today.
Certainly. One benefit of a healthy salt marsh is what it does for the aquatic and wildlife that live or should live in this ecosystem. Suzanne Payton, the supervisory fish and wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, knows all about that, and she's here with us via Zoom. Ms. Payton, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You're familiar with our neck of the woods, or our neck of the marsh, I guess I should say, through your work with the Southern New England Estuary Project. What is the purpose of that project?
So our work within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is to support conservation efforts that benefit our what we refer to as our federal trust species. So those are species that are protected under federal laws or species that we're concerned about based on recent declines and species we consider at risk.
And there are species, of course, of wildlife, both fish and land animals that live in a healthy salt marsh. What specifically can you give us some examples of the animals and perhaps reptiles that make a salt marsh their home?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a wide variety of species that utilize salt marsh habitats, including marine animals. You know, as the salt marshes are really at that interface between the upland and the ocean environments, and so there are some species that are marine species that, you know, come up into the salt marsh to spawn. Fish species use those areas as estuaries where the young, you know, grow up basically and flourish in those habitats. There are lots of bird species that utilize the marsh for different parts of their life history. A lot of species like egrets and herons that we see foraging in the marshes. And then there are select number of species that spend their entire life in the marsh, and salt marsh sparrow are one of those species. And that's a species that we've become very concerned about in recent years, because again, they spend their entire life in the salt marsh. So they nest, they build their nests and raise their young in the salt marsh itself. And so they're very vulnerable being a specialist species like that.
Is the salt marsh then being that area between uplands and in the ocean, does that make it really a unique ecosystem? And the wildlife that live there, are they largely unique to that area?
Yes, very much so. And again, it doesn't necessarily support species for their entire life history. Some species use it for different parts of their life cycle, but it's an incredibly important component of very many species' life history. And you know, critically important to species that have evolved to specialize in that type of habitat.
What sorts of elements of a salt marsh do the species take to? Is it the peat? Is it the grasses that grow there? What elements are attractive to these species?
So it depends. Yeah, it depends on the species. But with salt marsh sparrow in particular, I think the reason that we're finding that they are declining so rapidly, and we are estimating, well, a couple of years ago, we estimated that we've lost about 87% of the population of salt marsh sparrows from their breeding range. And this is a species, their entire worldwide distribution, they breed from Maine to northern Virginia on the east coast of the United States. And that's the only place they exist in the world. And so and they only nest and live in salt marsh habitats. They do spend the winter in the southern United States, but they breed, you know, in the Northeast. And, you know, in a typical salt marsh, there are a variety of plant species that have been adapted to different levels of salinity, being able to, you know, the tides come in twice a day and go out. And so all of the plants are adapted to some level of inundation with salt water. But some are more salt tolerant than others. And so you find these different zones within a healthy marsh. And the least tolerant salt marsh grasses, that what we call the high marsh plants, grow in areas that only flood during the full moon or the new moon high tide. So often that's only twice a month. So that gives a sparrow potentially 25, 26 days between those big tides that reach all the way up to the highest elevations within the marsh, until the next big tide comes in. And what they do is, as soon as, you know, they synchronize, as soon as that big tide comes in and out, then they get out there and they build their nest, they lay their eggs, they raise those chicks, and they have to get them out of there, you know, before that next tide cycle comes in, or their flood, their chicks will drown, or their eggs could flood. So that's why they're really a specialist.
Well, no pressure there. So you mentioned the decline of the salt marsh sparrows in terms of numbers. Have any species been totally lost because of damage that's been done to salt marshes over the past, well, I guess, 100, 200, 300 years?
That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure if there aren't species in other parts of the world. We did recently, the Fish and Wildlife Service recently listed the black rail. They're now protected under the Endangered Species Act. They are also a species that lives in salt marshes. Their range is a little bit south of Connecticut, although we are at the northern end of their range, and we used to have some here. We no longer, as far as I know, we no longer have any breeding in Connecticut. But that is a species that's also experiencing declines.
We've been talking to various people who are involved in restoring salt marshes, the ecosystems of salt marshes. I'm wondering, do species naturally show up when an ecosystem is restored, when a salt marsh is restored, or would you need to bring them back into the environment in order to repopulate?
Actually, I mean, as far as I have seen, they're incredibly resilient, and they will find those marshes once they are, again, providing suitable habitat. You know, if you know, the egrets and herons, for example, that are foraging in the marshes will fly over. They'll stop and look to see if there's any fish in those pools, if there are fish in the creeks coming into the marsh. And the salt marsh sparrows will return. They're very site faithful, so they like to return to the place where they were born or to the place where they raised their young in the previous year. And so they will tend to go back there first. And we're still learning how well they disperse. If they return to that site and it's no longer capable of supporting their nesting attempts, how far they might move to look for another suitable site. So our goal is to implement these restoration projects a little bit at a time, not to disturb all of the habitat at a site, but to build resiliency at a site, and then allow the birds to hopefully move from one location to another as we're bringing them back online, or that we're restoring the integrity of the sites.
Are the wildlife in a salt marsh in any way like, you know, the canary in the coal mine? Can you determine the health of a marsh, a salt marsh, based on the behavior of the wildlife that live there?
Yeah, I think that's a really good analogy. We're very concerned. When we started seeing the rapid declines of salt marsh sparrow, I think that was one of the things that really made us realize that. And a lot of folks, you know, when you look out at the marsh, it might still look green and it still has plants growing on it. But when we took a closer look, we realized that it's the more salt tolerant species that are sort of marching landward and taking over, because the marsh is flooding more and more often. And with sea level rise happening at a more rapid pace, those areas are starting to be inundated more often, and the plants are dying back and the more salt tolerant species are taking over. And we're realizing that even in areas that still look like a high marsh that a bird might be able to nest in, if we get a big rain event during the middle of the breeding season in the summer, those nests could still flood from stormwater runoff. If our marshes are surrounded by impervious surfaces, the water, you know, is flowing into the marsh, you get a lot of water on the marsh, even on top of what they're already experiencing with the tides.
And with rising sea levels, is that going to have, or is that having an effect also on the wildlife that that live there?
Yes, absolutely. So what we're seeing is that these tides are coming in, you know, there are higher tides, more high tides every month. And so that window of time that the birds have to nest is shrinking and getting shorter and shorter. And so that is a big concern. We do, you know, salt marshes evolved in this environment, and they have their own internal mechanisms to maintain as sea levels have been rising over many years. The marshes build elevation. The vegetation can trap sand or other sediment that's suspended in the water column when the tides come in. They build their own roots, and they, you know, the vegetation itself grows, and the peat that they grow in expands. The material that dies back every year builds an organic layer on the surface. So there are all these internal ways that the plants, if they're growing in a healthy environment, will build elevation to keep up. So marshes that have not been historically manipulated are doing a better job of keeping up. But about 90% of the marshes across New England have either been ditched or diked over the last couple hundred years. And that ditching and alterations has interfered with the normal hydrological cycle. So water gets up on the marsh and maybe gets behind an old berm that a farmer created, and it doesn't drain off. Or you know, the digging of those ditches degraded the peat, so the peat has compressed. And those impacts, we realize, are making the marsh less able to deal with this new threat of sea level rise.
Where does restoration go from here?
So part of what we're trying to figure out is that's exactly the question. and it's really site specific. So in a site that has a lot of ditches and a lot of old berms and disturbance, we find that if we can do just really sort of what we're calling low impact measures to try and restore the health of the marsh and give it back its healthy state, you know, it's sort of like unclog the arteries, figure out, you know, like the marsh has heart disease and we're trying to diagnose what do we need to do to make it healthy. And then that healthy marsh will have a better chance of dealing with climate change and these sea level rise and everything else that's coming forward. So in some of the marshes, if we catch them soon enough, we can just, you know, we put some material in the ditches, we try to minimize the number of ditches, restore a more natural hydrology, more natural channel system. But in some of the marshes, they're so far gone, they're converting to open water, they're mud flats. those sites we're targeting for sediment placement, or you know, if we have dredge material, we can place a layer of material on the marsh. Those will take longer to revegetate and come back to be a full healthy marsh, but they need a, you know, they need a jump start, so to speak, to get them back to the right elevation to be able to have the right tidal regime, if that makes sense.
Suzanne Payton is the supervisory fish and wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, working through the Southern New England Estuary Project on salt marshes in our region. Ms. Payton, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was fun to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Our last guest mentioned how the salt marsh sparrow population has been affected by the loss of this unique wetland marsh. Now let's learn more about this sparrow and the challenge to its survival. Corey Folsom O'Keefe, the director of bird conservation with Audubon Connecticut, is here on Zoom. Welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what does a salt marsh sparrow look like? I took a look online. It looks like a very small bird.
It is a small bird. You know, they're you know, mostly brown, various shades of brown. They spend a lot of their time in salt marsh grasses. So I feel like they are not an easy bird to get a look at, but they are a pretty fascinating bird.
We just spoke with Suzanne Payton with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and she mentioned that the numbers of salt marsh sparrows have dropped quite a bit in the region. What has Audubon Connecticut seen?
Well, you know, so there is a lot of effort going on to sort of study the salt marsh sparrow. And, you know, not necessarily Audubon Connecticut, but there's a project called the SHARP Project that has been monitoring salt marsh nesting birds up and down the coastline. And what they've been able to document is a 9% annual decline in the salt marsh sparrow, you know, basically over the last 20 years. So, you know, there was roughly 60,000 birds back in 2010, and we're down to about 30,000 birds across their entire range, which stretches from just Virginia to Maine.
Given the unique salt marsh ecosystem and the limited breeding time that these sparrows have, those larger numbers that you mentioned, are they considered large in the greater scheme of things? It seems like with such a small area that they're... that they live in, that you couldn't really have a large number.
Well, you certainly could have more than we have right now.
Yeah.
This is, you know, we're basically, you know, the salt marsh sparrow is a bird that is probably the species that is most impacted by sea level rise. They sort of actually time their breeding cycle with the tides. And what they do is they say fly up to Connecticut, and they will be coming to Connecticut in the next 1 to 2 weeks. And they will all arrive on the breeding grounds. They will all start nesting. And then when we get our next full moon, all of those nests will get wiped out. They will all get washed out. And then the birds all start nesting immediately again afterwards. So they've got to build their nest, they got to lay their eggs, they have to incubate their eggs, and they have to get their chicks to at least 5 days old before the next full moon high tide happens. You know, so full moons are, you know, 28 days apart. These birds need between 24 and 26 days to actually get their nesting cycle in. And what's happening is, you know, our highest tides are at the full moons, but we also get fairly high tides, you know, higher than normal around the new moon. So, or when, you know, there is no moon to see. And with sea level rise, those tides at the new moon are getting higher. And it's actually, you know, basically that, you know, 24, 26 day period that these birds need to get in their nest is getting sort of cut in half because of sea level rise at the new moon tide. And so the species really is failing to get in its nesting cycles. You know, so they're not able to sort of, you know, raise their young in the, you know, without their nest getting flooded out.
You mentioned that the drop in numbers have been noted for about the past 20 years, the 9% annual drop. Were the numbers dropping prior to that? Is that when the sort of the counting began 20 years ago, or was the diminishment happening before that?
It's definitely been going on since the early 2000s. You know, before that, it, you know, maybe it was the species wasn't as much of a concern, but this this drop is pretty dramatic. And, you know, basically, if we get down to about 10,000 birds, that's really the critical point. You know, if we get to that point, it's going to be hard for this species to be able to recover. And with 9% decline per year, we could be at just 10,000 birds in 10 years. And so Audubon and our partners are working really hard to figure out ways to make the sort of high marsh habitat, which is where these birds nest, more resilient to sea level rise. So we can figure out ways to sort of help the salt marsh sparrow continue to thrive and sort of maintain a population level of 25,000 birds. I mean, that, you know, doesn't, it sort of sounds like a lot, but that's a good number. That is, you know, we'd love to have more salt marsh sparrow, but, you know, 25,000 is a good number, you know, but we really want to avoid getting down to just 10,000. If we get down to just 10,000 birds, then it's going to start to get much harder to keep, you know, prevent the species from going extinct.
We've been talking with several groups during the program about efforts to restore the salt marsh system in the region, in Connecticut, around the Sound. How does Audubon Connecticut fit into that work?
Well, I think a lot of the work is in partnership, but one thing that we're doing right now is you know, Audubon Connecticut is working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, and the state of Connecticut on the Great Meadows Marsh Restoration Project in Stratford, Connecticut. And one of the components of this project is we are creating these mounds in high marsh habitat with hopes that once these mounds are sort of revegetated, that the salt marsh sparrow will actually nest on top of these mounds. And then during those big flood events associated with the full moon or the new moon, or even just a storm like the one we had this past Monday night, their nest will be at this higher level and they'll be able to sort of withstand those flooding events. And that's sort of, it's just one of those sort of strategies that's out there to sort of, you know, kind of come up with ways that we can, you know, make the salt marsh sparrow more resilient when it comes to these flooding events.
Sounds like you're optimistic that the salt marsh sparrow can, at the very least, still be with us, if not make a stronger comeback.
I hope so. I mean, I think the salt marsh sparrow is a high priority for so many conservation organizations right now. You know, Audubon Connecticut, which is part of the National Audubon Society, you know, we are sort of realize the threat this bird faces, and you know, the threat to the salt marsh sparrow is also somewhat indicative of the sort of threats to our coastal communities, you know, because the salt marshes are such valuable habitat, not just to birds and wildlife, but to people too. They, you know, they can absorb floodwaters during storms. They sequester carbon. They're nurseries for our recreational and commercial fish species. So they are incredibly important ecosystems. And so we want to make those ecosystems as a whole as resilient as possible, not only to save the salt marsh sparrow, but to make sure that our coastlines and our, you know, the economy and the safety of people who live on the coastlines is kept intact. You know, so it's a high priority for Audubon. It's a high priority for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, for the Atlantic Coast Joint Venture, you know, for the state of Connecticut, NOAA. I mean, there's a lot of different entities that are putting a lot of attention to, you know, this bird right now, but more so its habitat.
Corey Folsom O'Keefe is the Director of Bird Conservation with Audubon Connecticut. Ms. Folsom O'Keefe, thank you so much for your time today and your insights about the salt marsh sparrow. We appreciate that.
You're welcome very much, and have a great day.
Thank you. You too. So maybe our conversations today have piqued your curiosity and perhaps inspired you to explore a salt marsh for yourself. One place to start is the Long Island Aquarium in Riverhead, which has an interactive salt marsh program. Here on Zoom to tell us about it is Teddy Tilken, a senior aquarist with the aquarium. Mr. Tilken, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. Interactive salt marsh aside for the moment, what can we see and do at the Long Island Aquarium?
Oh, there's a whole lot to see and do. We have a variety of different habitats of different animals from all over the globe, mainly in the ocean, but we do have some outliers as well, a few different species of mammals that are scattered throughout and birds. But for the most part, we are a full-fledged aquarium. We have sharks and jellyfish. and a bunch of other cool exotic fish from all around the world in a nice reef tank as well. So,
And what's your work as an aquarist?
As an aquarist, my job is to maintain and take care of a lot of those fish tanks. So everything from feeding to the daily husbandry of water changes and water quality, and along with working on other special projects and new exhibits and things that we have in the works later on down the line.
Tell us about the salt marsh. Where is it? How big is it? Was it there, or did the aquarium restore one that had been removed or destroyed or damaged somehow?
So our salt marsh was built by us. It's not on. It's not necessarily a fully real salt marsh, but more or less a way for guests to see exactly what a salt marsh entails. Mm-hmm. And be interactive with it where they're then not actually damaging a real life salt marsh as well. Because sometimes walking through a salt marsh, going through some of the plant life and all that can actually cause some damages. So our interactive experience allows guests to see what a salt marsh would look like, interact with some of the animals that are in there with not actually affecting a working salt marsh in the wild.
So maybe you could talk more about how it's interactive. I understand the need to protect the real salt marshes, but wanting to give people an experience that will expose them to what they are and what they do. So how is it interactive? I noticed in connection with that on your website, the aquarium invites visitors who are, quote, 42.5 inches or taller to take off their shoes to get an up-close look at the marine life. So people actually walk directly into the waters of your marsh and explore the site. Is that how it's interactive?
Absolutely. So in the salt marsh, we have a few different species of local animals from Long Island waters, ranging from spider crabs, horseshoe crabs, and whelk snails. And all of these animals are placed in the salt marsh and are watched over by our staff. And then the guests are allowed to come in. They can interact with the crabs by touching them as they go through the water. They could also just kind of enter their element and see how they're behaving with not only them entering the water, but the other animals around them as well.
So. And again, so literally visitors can get their feet wet, so to speak.
Yeah, you can take off your shoes, walk through, you can touch some crabs, you can do everything, but pretty much we prefer if you didn't swim in the tank, if you just stayed on your 2 feet at all times. But absolutely, you're more than welcome to venture through and explore.
Why is it important, do you think, for people to interact with a salt marsh in this manner, to understand what's going on? Is it part of the mission of the aquarium to bring people into close contact with a natural environment like a salt marsh?
Absolutely. There are so many different, extremely important natural environments that we try to showcase and educate the public to have them learn about. Because if you're able to learn about something, you learn to sometimes love that and then protect that as that issue as well. So for salt marshes, they are extremely important, especially for Long Island, considering we as an island are surrounded by water and surrounded by salt marshes. We have marshland all throughout the island that acts as, one, a huge protection for storms, especially for our local coastlines. They act as like a buffer for incoming waves and high tides that can cause massive amounts of erosion. They also are refuge and a nursery to almost every type of animal that you can find, ranging from mammals to birds to fish, reptiles. They all use the salt marsh to either nest or house themselves. A lot of fish use it as nurseries, and birds use it as nurseries as well. And then I think one of the most important things of all of that is the filtration that salt marshes provide to our waterways. The water that's coming in on high tide and then going back out in low tide is entering all these different plant life. There's a lot of different filter feeders from mussels and clams and oysters So that water is getting filtered, cleaned, and then returned back to the ocean. So all of those are extremely essential to making sure our environment stays healthy. So for the guests to come in, interact, and learn about what a salt marsh is, that is an extremely important issue that we like to try to fix and work on here. So,
how long has the salt marsh been part of the aquarium's exhibits?
About 15, 20 years. So the aquarium has been open since around 1999 to 2000. So that was a little later on, a few years after that, before my time, but that was built in pretty early on.
You mentioned before that one of the purposes of your salt marsh at the aquarium is to give people an opportunity to interact with the marsh without actually interrupting or damaging a real marsh out in the wild, so to speak. Is that something that you emphasize with visitors when they do interact with your marsh, that it's okay to do it here, but don't do it on the coast?
There's definitely, especially when we have programs with school groups that go into it, they're taught a lot more about the marshes. And guests that come in, they're even not really supposed to walk through a lot of the plant life that we have as well. And they're told all of that just to try to keep our marsh healthy as well and looking sharp. So there's a lot of education that does go into every guest that comes into the interactive salt marsh.
And if someone wants to know more about your aquarium, perhaps schools, educators who would like to get in touch, what's the best way to do that?
We have a website where you are more than, where we have tons of different resources, at longislandaquarium.com.
Teddy Tilken is a senior aquarist with the Long Island Aquarium in Riverhead. Mr. Tilken, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too. So are you ready to kick off your shoes and explore the interactive salt marsh? Want to help save the marsh sparrow? Tell us about that. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org. We're on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. That's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.